Hey, it's Melissa from Melissa in the Morning on WICC 600. And thanks for checking out the podcast right here. If you want, you can always subscribe, share, and like it. Hope to see you guys soon. Thanks.
And now, a few minutes with U.S. Senator Richard Blumenthal on WICC 600.
Good morning, Senator Blumenthal. So glad that you could be here this morning. This week has been kind of... it's been very difficult, kind of challenging, especially for anti-vaxxers. The J&J pause was certainly kind of a shock to the nation. Recently, Governor Lamont was saying that the CDC acted too early, basically. He was saying, look, that announcement kind of just drove more people to not want to get the vaccine. What were sort of your thoughts on it? Do you think that it was premature to pause the vaccine? Do you agree with the fact that they're still pausing it until next week at least? What are your thoughts on it this morning?
This pause should be very, very brief. Members of my family have received the Johnson & Johnson vaccine without even any side effects. And I have a lot of hope, at least, and substantial confidence that Johnson & Johnson will be back in use once they determine exactly who might be vulnerable to these blood clots. Remember, they are very, very rare compared to the total. That's the reason that the governor thought maybe they erred on the side of caution, meaning erred by making a mistake. But I think scientifically they had an obligation to pause very briefly simply to determine the causes and effects.
I mean, I agree. I think it's a very hard situation. It's one of those situations, kind of like the last time you and I talked, and we were saying how the White House knew about something, waited a couple of weeks, and then we started to find out about it. And even, you know, people at your status didn't know necessarily. Like, it's a hard call sometimes when to let the general public know about things. But something like this, when we are pushing people to get the vaccine, I don't think they had any other decision, Senator Blumenthal, than to say, listen, let's just put a pause on this because God forbid more people have this happen and we don't have the answers why.
If you think of the alternative, what if they had, in effect, kept it secret and declined to pause, and eventually it would have come out, everything comes out eventually, it would have tremendously discredited the scientific community at the FDA and the CDC.
I agree with you. Now, Senator Blumenthal, I want to switch gears a little bit because it was interesting. I got an email from a listener. I've been talking a little bit about this in my newscasts lately, and I actually saw another news publication talk about this in the last 24 hours. We are hearing from a lot of local businesses in Fairfield and New Haven County. I'm sure it's across Connecticut, where they cannot get people to apply for open positions. Now, I find this very interesting because we're still in the pandemic. We still have hundreds of thousands of people who are claiming unemployment, but we're starting to see more and more jobs open up, the economy open up, opportunities open up, but people don't want to take the jobs because their unemployment benefits are so good. Now, I know that that's obviously important that people have unemployment, but do you find, Senator Blumenthal, that this might be bad news for local businesses? It could mean them not being able to fill positions, so they may have to shut down. I'm just wondering if in the near future, the unemployment might end up actually backfiring on our local economy.
You know, the expanded and extended unemployment benefits have been a godsend for countless families. I've heard from them all around the state, literally hundreds, maybe thousands of people have been kept in their homes. They put food on the table and maintain the basic minimal living standards because of this expanded benefit. Of course, as you know, the benefits drop. The plus-up has dropped from $600 to $300. It's really pretty minimal at this point. So maybe as it phases out, more people will apply for those jobs, but they need to know about them. And the employers, God bless them, are expanding their workforces apparently, which is great for the economy. And this unemployment assistance the expansion of it will be phased out.
I mean, yeah, I just think, Senator, I definitely worry. Like, I've seen countless restaurants with help wanted signs. I'm hearing it from local business owners. And I think what's troubling is they're trying to come up with incentives and benefits and bonus packages and sign on bonuses and all kinds of stuff that, quite frankly, they can't even really afford. So I just don't know if there's a middle ground here. I just worry that I understand and I completely agree with you. I think in the height and even in the last year of the pandemic, if we did not have this unemployment, I think we would have just completely crumbled as a nation. I totally agree with you. But now we've gotten to a point where we are rebuilding enough that people just don't want to apply for jobs right now. I don't really know if I agree that they're not advertising it enough. I think businesses are doing everything they can without breaking the bank to let people know they've got positions open, and no one's taking them.
I'd love to talk to some of the businesses that are experiencing this difficulty in finding people who want to work, because almost all the folks I've talked to who were laid off or temporarily paused in their employment really want to go back to work. They are very eager to return to the workplace, and I'd like to talk about ways that we can help those small businesses looking for people to fill the job.
I mean, I was going to say, I've just only in the last couple of months, I think I've been in touch with countless local businesses. And instead of me reaching out to each and every one of them, for anyone who's listening right now, is there like a general email or some way of contacting you if they are finding specifically that they're having trouble with this?
Well, my office email, you know, my website is publicized widely, and they can post there or send an email to my official account. But here's the important point, Melissa. The more people who are able to put food on the table, stay in their homes, and clothe their children, the better our economy is overall during a period of economic crisis. We're emerging from that crisis. Unemployment insurance exists to keep people in their homes and put food on the table. But once unemployment diminishes come the spring or summer, the additional or expanded amount of unemployment insurance will be phased out according to the law. And the other point is that if somebody refuses to go back to work when there's a job, they can be denied unemployment assistance. That's the law.
So when does it diffuse, Senator Blumenthal? When does the expanded unemployment diffuse?
Over the summer into the fall.
Okay, because that's my only concern is that you've got local businesses trying to rebuild over the last year, and if they can't survive till the end of the summer, early fall, it's like we're kind of back at square one where now they need unemployment, I would think. So that's my only concern there.
My information from local businesses, Melissa, is that the Paycheck Protection Program is helping. They want to reopen. If they can reopen responsibly under the governor's guidelines, they're mm-hmm. doing it, and they're doing it very well. If they're having trouble finding people to come to work, the Labor Department ought to be notified, and individuals should be notified as well. The State Labor Department can notify people who are looking for work or people who are on unemployment.
Senator Blumenthal, always a pleasure to talk to you. Thank you so much, and we'll talk again next week.
Wonderful. Thank you.
Well, you've been hearing us talk about it here on the show, and we're very excited now to have Deb Greenwood with us from the Center for Family Justice. Deb, welcome back to the show. How are you?
I'm great. How are you? Good morning.
Doing fine. Yeah, good morning to you. Now, I know we've got a walk a mile in her shoes coming up. This is the second year in a row, Deb, that we're going to be having this event virtual for good reason. But first of all, talk a little bit about the significance of this event. Why should people get involved?
Sure. So thank you. Well, April is National Sexual Assault Awareness Month, as well as Child Abuse Prevention Month. So we have an incredible group of men and women that are part of our White Ribbon campaign. And all year long, we raise awareness and focus in April on our Walk a Mile in Our Shoes. And what we do during this walk is, because it's been virtual, we're asking people in our community to walk around the block, walk individually, socially distanced and safe, raising proceeds and awareness on the importance, because we know 1 in 5 women and 1 in 14 boys in our state are affected by sexual assaults. And we've seen such a spike in abuse during the pandemic. Mm-hmm. These much-needed proceeds will help children under the age of 18 in our Camp Hope America Bridgeport program that we support on a weekly basis that have been victims of trauma and been affected by abuse. And we work with these children year-long so that eventually what happens, they find hope. They will also become advocates and supporters in our community by raising awareness through our Walk a Mile in Her Shoes. We are helping support individuals that live in our communities that need our help and free confidential support.
And Deb, you know what I think is interesting is a big part of the walk is getting men and boys specifically to join in the effort, correct?
It is, exactly. And, you know, getting their advocacy as young men and boys to be able to stand up and not be bystanders, to be able to change the culture, which we have been doing, especially on our college campuses, in our high schools, even in our middle schools. It's never too early to start help educating young boys and men the importance of not being able to violate or abuse young girls or women. So the education and prevention is equally as important. So we can get in front of this topic and start to change the culture, which we are seeing in everyday life. So very important to be able to put a spotlight on our Walk a Mile in Her Shoes, which this year will be our 9th year.
Wow. And I love the idea, Deb Greenwood, that we're kind of making, you know, just showing this statement of men and boys being allies in this effort. I think that's a very powerful thing.
Absolutely. And, you know, what's been so incredible, I really want to put a big shout out to former chief of police in Fairfield, now executive director of public safety at Sacred Heart University, Gary McNamara. Gary and I met several years ago and put our thinking caps on together over a cup of coffee in a local diner and said, this might be a great event. It's a national event, the Walk a Mile in Her Shoes, but this might be something where we can get people engaged. Never did we realize pre-pandemic that we had 1,500 walk down the post road in Fairfield, and it really gained momentum, and obviously we had to stop the in-person, but we didn't stop the effort. And I think that really speaks volumes to the White Ribbon campaign that's being led, not only by, of course, the great leadership of Gary McNamara, but also all of the other chiefs of police in our 6 towns we serve, as well as community leaders at our local universities, leadership in our high schools, and community leaders such as Aquarion, who has been sponsoring this event for the last 5 years now. And from the small to the large sponsors and the individuals and the young kids and people that have walked, and whether they've raised $10 or they walk to just send us a photo or a video that we post on social media, it really has started a conversation with our young people. Mm-hmm. And that's what's been so incredibly positive to see in such a negative atmosphere that we've all lived through in the past year, especially during COVID, and seeing the increase in abuse, whether it's been domestic violence, sexual violence, and child abuse, 3 very key issues of services we provide at the Center for Family Justice. Our hotlines have had a 56% increase in calls.
Wow.
With that being said, this is really an important effort and initiative that we bring our 6 communities together with, and especially, again, having young people be able to advocate, especially young men and boys.
Deb, I wanted to talk about some really exciting news at the center. My understanding is that you guys just announced you're building what's called Empower House. First of all, what is it and how can people, you know, be involved with this?
Oh, yes. So we have, prior to the pandemic, we had a task force put together to look at the issues of running our domestic violence safe house, which we are one of 18 agencies in the state of Connecticut. And our service area is the Bridgeport, Easton, Fairfield, Monroe, Trumbull, Stratford area. However, a victim of domestic violence, certainly that needs safety and a place to go when they need to get out of that abusive household, always can work with us, calling a hotline, working with law enforcement in the center. That being said, the current house we've had for over 22 years was great then, but the rooms were not as big. Families have gotten larger, and we didn't have enough space. We also looked at having more program space at the Domestic Violence Safe House. That being said, we continued with this project and during the pandemic found a location at an undisclosed area, twice as big in space, large programmatic areas where especially children that are sheltering there with their parents. Now we'll have a computer learning lab as well as the client themselves to be able to get financial literacy support, as well as computer learning labs, a meditation room, indoor safe space, as well as potentially at some point a place where the pet may come as well. We know many times victims will not leave because they have no place to leave their pet. And we know how important that is to so many victims. So we had done a great study with not only past clients, of course, our incredible staff at the Center for Family Justice, as well as volunteers. Through that, we did get great support from individual donors and some others, and we found a location. Unfortunately, I can't disclose where that is, but I will say it is certainly in the greater Bridgeport area. The rooms are incredible family suites with everything that I just mentioned, as well as having a place for solidarity as well as serenity and being able to move forward with self-sufficiency. So we have named the project the Empower House. We officially closed on this new house just a week ago. So we are now moving forward on transforming the interior of it, making what I just mentioned come to life, and being able to move our location so that we can take more people. Because during this pandemic, what we've seen is an incredible amount of people that cannot even get into a safe place, and they're living in hotels. We're seeing an average of 12 to 15 adults and children every month that have been living in hotels throughout our entire state. But in the greater Bridgeport area, we have seen these numbers spiking. We want people to call the hotline. We know there's a great need to get out into a safe environment. Living in the hotels is the best we can do while we are making room and getting the Empower House project ready. So this will be our big announcement. We unveiled this on March 26th at our 125th virtual gala just recently. And now thank you for the opportunity to be able to say that. So if someone wanted to get involved and support and help, they can go on our microsite, which is empowerhouseproject.org, and they can see exactly what I'm talking about, and they can certainly either get involved, they can make a donation, they can help support this effort, and we are going to actually be having a shower for the house. We're calling it a shower to empower. We're going to need pots, pans, towels, sheets, all kinds of things that anyone would need if they were opening and starting their own home. So more to come on that, and that will be found on that link, empowerhouseproject.org.
That is so cool. And Deb, really quick, I mean, maybe this is too early to ask you this, but any idea ballpark when that's going to open and how many people that could service? Like, how many people would you guys be able to house there?
Certainly. So we're hoping for early to mid-fall to be able to cut the ribbon and actually have this happen, because now that we own the house, we're going to be moving steadfastly on the fundraising component as well as looking at the transformation of some of the rooms. In addition to handicap accessibility, a very important part of the work that we do, rebuilding a handicap ramp, having ADA accessibility, everything on the first floor. So looking at all of this being able to happen, we're looking at mid-fall as a time to cut the ribbon and celebrate the Empower House project being completed.
That is so exciting. Deb Greenwood with the Center for Family Justice. Really quick before I let you go, what is your hotline? Where can people go if they want your services, they want to talk to somebody there?
Yes, 24 hours a day, 7 days a week. You will always get an individual to call our hotline. If you are a victim of domestic violence, the following number can be found on our website at centerforfamilyjustice.org. 1-888-774-2900. That's 1-888-774-2900.
Deb Greenwood, always a pleasure to have you on. Thank you so much. We so appreciate it. And again, don't forget, if you want to get involved with Walk a Mile in Her Shoes, you can head to their website, centerforfamilyjustice.org, and learn more on how you could take your own walk or even form a team and raise money for such incredible work that happens at the Center for Family Justice. Deb, such a pleasure. Thank you so much.
Thank you so much. Thank you for helping raise awareness. We appreciate it.
Absolutely. Looking forward to talking to you again really soon. We are connecting with Stephanie Swantek this morning, our biweekly visit with Stephanie. She is with the Be Safe Project out of Bridges Healthcare in Milford. And Steph, I love this topic today because I specifically can relate to both sides of this. So I have a husband who I love very, very dearly, but he is he was kind of encouraged as a kid, or I should say grew up in a household where he had sort of a militant background, and getting in touch with your feelings was just kind of a no-no. It wasn't that he couldn't. It was just sort of frowned upon, and it was kind of like, oh, you'd kind of get ragged on for it. And now, you know, here we are 30 years later, and we've got a son. We've got a young son. And one of the things that I find I talk to my husband a lot about, because it's very new for him, is that I want my son to grow up the opposite way. I want him to grow up knowing it's completely okay, and I think actually more manly, when men are in touch with their emotions and their feelings. Would you agree with that, or do you think the mentality of like guys should mask it and just kind of suck it up and do what they need to do, is that more the better approach?
So vulnerability, right? Thank you for that question. Like, vulnerability is a human need, right? It's mm-hmm. it's the need to connect. It's the need to feel. It's empathy. It's mutual respect, right? But it's understanding where someone else comes from and being able to sit with those feelings and work through those feelings. So it also translates and results in compromise and again, just being able to feel the stuff. So you don't just, again, as you just mentioned, go through the motions. And mm-hmm. The more uncomfortable we are with being vulnerable, the more we hide behind the masculinity. We mm-hmm. use it as that mask, as you mentioned.
Mm-hmm. I mean, do you think it, you know, how do we create, I would say, how do we make strong men out of our young boys? I know, like, right now there's such a focus, and for good reason. You know, you've got a lot of movements going on, you know, the Me Too movement. We continue to see more and more of these cases come out. I mean, right now, look, we're in the midst of what's going on with Governor Andrew Cuomo and a lot of accusations there. How do we mm-hmm. assure that we are raising our boys to be good men?
So first off, it's all about communication and talking. But boys, specifically boys, or those who identify as boys, like mom will always play that, you know, or that whoever plays that mother figure in that boy's life, right? Usually they end up relying on to talk to them about, you know, their feelings or a partner, right? A female partner or a female friend. But usually the boys rely on those females. But then that, if they're constantly relying on a female, even growing up, then usually when they continue to grow and they turn into an adult, then they still rely on their female partners to kind of, you know, work through that, their emotional side. So it ends up becoming the responsibility of that female. So what boys need, and what boys are based on research, but boys want to hear from their fathers or their, that father figure. Like, they want to talk about, you know, like the emotional side of intimacy, right? And relationships, and about sex, and even things like, you know, their father's regrets.
So that the boys that's
can
strong.
Be like, yes, wow. they can connect, right? And that creates that vulnerability. And that's how you model vulnerability. So it's a family dynamic, but specifically those fathers. And then that's what translates, again, as those boys feeling strong and feeling their stuff, and not just, you know, kind of creating more like of a hookup culture, right? Like sleeping mm-hmm. around with many women, or just going, because that's the same thing. If I'm just hooking up with a lot of people, then I'm it turns into there's no connection there. I'm just going through the motions, and I'm so afraid of being vulnerable that I get caught in these negative relationships.
Do you think, Stephanie Swantek, it's a good idea to almost have like a universal understanding? Like it's not just the dads, but beyond it, is it worth having a conversation with the uncles, the grandfathers, the male figures in a boy's life? Like is it important to make sure everyone's kind of on the same page, or is it really just it comes down to the father figure in that person's life?
So anyone who plays again like that role in that child's life. So it could be a little bit a mentor. It could anyone who that child looks up to, and but also the quote unquote male figure that these boys quote unquote are looking to talk to. They have to also be comfortable with these things. So this isn't easy either, right? Like and also
yeah.
Again, I we always talk about that. Like a lot of these conversations are not. They're not easy to have, but they don't need to be perfect. They're not looking for, and that's actually a problem, the need for perfection or parents mm-hmm. needing to appear that they live perfect lives. No, they want to hear about all the bad stuff so they can connect with them further, and that's vulnerability.
So how do adult men break that barrier, Steph? Like how do we, you know, because you're right, I think it's hard to lead by example or to have these vulnerable talks with young boys if you, as the adult male, if you aren't comfortable even thinking about this from your own perspective, or you weren't raised like, I think this concept yeah. of being open and comfortable and vulnerable, you know, that's never equated strength. You know, like that's always had a weird stigma of like, there's no way if I have feelings that I'm a strong guy. I mean, that's just always, it's always been like that. And I think that this is such a great topic as we move forward to the next generation. But how do we break that barrier? Like, how do we start that for adult men?
So first off, you're right, right? Like, historically, vulnerability appeared as weakness, but the
right.
truth is that if we're unable, doesn't matter who you are, to be vulnerable in any capacity with no one, that's what creates that lack of connection. And then we hide behind even, again, like negative coping mechanisms, or we rely on alcohol or something to then make us appear vulnerable. Like I may only tell my child I love them after I'm drunk, right, or something, so that I can't fully be present with those feelings. So we want to be vulnerable, we seek it, but we end up hiding behind something that's more socially acceptable. And I'm sorry, I lost your question there.
No, I think you kind of, I was saying like, you know, how do you start to break that barrier for adults?
So working on yourself, right? So again, like it doesn't matter who you are, how you identify, maybe talking about someone that you trust even as an adult and start there, right?
Mm-hmm.
So start there, and then when you do feel comfortable, baby talks. And like research compares this even to like table manners, like with your kids. Like you wouldn't just say, okay, here's the fork, here's the spoon, here's your bib, or here's your napkin, and that's it. No, when you're sitting around a table, you're continually checking in usually with your kids, be like, hey, like, you know, wipe your face, oh, wash your hands, clean off your plate, and it's a constant conversation.
Mm-hmm.
So are these conversations around intimacy and relationships and just – you know, just connecting, you know, and sexuality, all these pieces. But it's a continual growth. And it's even a relationship with vulnerability. It's a relationship with intimacy. It's a relationship with connection. And that's how relationships grow all together.
Mm-hmm. Steph, if anybody is hearing this and they want to maybe talk to you privately, they want to get your advice on how to have more of these conversations and become comfortable with vulnerability, where can they reach out to you?
Yeah, so they're always welcome to call me, 475-202-2827. And I kind of just want to finish, too, with if we get more comfortable with having these conversations with our children, this is exactly what stems, like, hatred and homophobia
mm-hmm.
and violence. Because if I can't express myself, then that's what I turn to, right? I turn into, I'm so uncomfortable that I act out in this way or I treat people this way. I need to be in power of these people
point.
Because
mm-hmm.
I can't feel.
Wow, that's a really good point, Steph. Yeah, that's really true. Thank you for sharing that. I appreciate it.
Thank you, and have a beautiful week.
Thank you. You too.
Let's get wild. It's the Zoo Minute with Greg Dancho from Connecticut's Beardsley Zoo on Melissa in the Morning on WICC 600.
Hey, Greg, are you back in Connecticut or are you still in D.C. this morning?
I've always been in Connecticut. Didn't leave this year.
Ah.
We will talk a little bit about that.
So you did a little virtual meeting with some lawmakers in D.C.
Yeah, that's been the thing, right? Virtual is the bird is the word. Virtual is the thing to do.
That's very true.
Everybody knows that bird is the word, right?
I love that. Bird is the word. Of course, absolutely. Now, yesterday was AZA Advocacy Day in D.C. So what were some of the things that you brought up to legislators?
Well, one of the reasons we're doing this is that I've been doing I sit on the AZA Government Affairs Committee, and we've been meeting for a few months now. Normally, what we would do is go up to, like you said, go to Washington, go up on the Hill. We would have a couple meetings to talk about AZA's legislative agenda, and then we would go off onto meetings with our legislators or legislator staff. And we've been fairly good at that. And the reason why we've really made a big push is that a few years ago, when we had the last economic downturn, there was some monies given out to support institutions. But for some reason, zoos were left off the list. So back, I think it was during the recession, we were not able to get any federal funding to support our institutions, even though we were in a recession.
Really?
And that kind of got AZA's eyes open to say we really need to do a better job of two things. One, educating our legislators of what we actually do, and then lobbying and advocacy on some of the bills that we're looking at. So that's what we did. That's what we did virtually yesterday. We did it. I did it all day long. We did seven legislators. I also worked with Maritime Aquarium and Mystic Aquarium. We kind of teamed up because we are all AZA accredited facilities. We had yesterday over 200 zoo professionals doing virtual calls to legislators, encompassing over 37 states.
Oh wow, that's amazing!
So that was a huge thing, and that's where we in AZA we really are in 46 states. So we almost had everybody out there yesterday talking, and so we spent time. For those people who have never done gone and talked to legislators, I'm going to put a pitch in here. Do so once you get a chance to get up either Hartford or D.C. Really, it's the one-on-one personal work that you can do that makes the biggest change.
Yeah,
they want to hear from you and what you say, and that really makes a difference. So this is why this is so important for us to be up there yesterday, or not up there yesterday, and virtually up there yesterday.
Yeah.
And we did talk. We talked about the future, Preventing the Future Pandemics Act, which I think we touched on the show before, looking at the trade and wildlife of human consumption of our endangered animals and animals themselves, because we know now how lethal that is, or can be lethal, because of that zoonotic transmission from animals to humans or humans to animals. Mm-hmm. So we're really trying to cut the wildlife supply chain that's legal and illegal. One of the things that was really interesting talking to people about this, and AZA has been pushing this also, is getting funding for USAID to help those communities that rely on the consumption of wildlife for food security, because you always got to look at the human component and the animal component. It's challenging, but a lot of us in conservation and environmental issues, we really focus on the wildlife and the animals, but you always have to kind of have in the back of your mind there are people involved with this, either pro or con. So this whole thing about what we call about bushmeat, we talked about this before, we kind of have to figure out a way to have alternative animal and plant sourced foods for people who rely on that for their sustainability. So this was a big thing. And then increasing U.S. Fish and Wildlife, because a lot of funding has been cut there. We are partners with U.S. Fish and Wildlife. And so that getting them more funding to help do their work helps our work. And that kind of went into the next program that we're looking at, with the Funding for Endangered Species Recovery Challenge Grants. For many years, we've been working with animals such as our red bulls that are really owned by Fish and Wildlife. They're not really our animals. They're not zoos animals.
Right.
We're working in partnership with them to keep them, again, moving along, get the population numbers up, and then do the release programs. And what we're asking for now is saying, okay, if you give us more support on this, if we can get a grant to help increase our capacity, then we can increase
the efforts, the recovery efforts that Fish and Wildlife's doing that. And so that in our situation, that would be red wolves. In Mystic, it would be sea turtles, mm-hmm. and eagles, and all that kind of thing. If we can get a grant for that, that would help us reinforce the partnership, and get us moving more further mm-hmm. in helping those programs. So it was a good time, and we spent a long time on that. One of the things we're trying to do is get some more. We have two of our representatives have joined the Zoo and Aquarium Caucus.
Mm-hmm.
So we did put a push to the other representatives. The Zoo and Aquarium Caucus is about 53 bipartisan members now. And what we're trying to do is get as many representatives on that, because again, then you're getting AZA and you're getting our word directly into that caucus and getting that word out faster.
Right. So, I was curious, Greg, really quick. Was there any mention of a couple of things that you and I have talked about on the show, like, big cat trading in U.S.? Has that been talked about, or the turtle smuggling? Those are the two things that I know we've talked about a lot on the show. Was that discussed at all?
A lot of this goes into Preventing the Future Pandemics Act,
mm-hmm.
Which is preventing the import and export of animals,
mm-hmm.
So that turtles are part of that. And we are looking also at there was another bill that was, I'm trying to look for what it was. It was on strengthening the Fish and Wildlife Program that can stop all this.
Mm-hmm.
The big cat program is something that we're working on locally and federally. I don't think there's a bill this year on this, but I know in Hartford that we've been working on this, and I'm pretty sure that's been passing through the ranks right now. So we're hoping that bill is going to be passed this year.
Okay. No, that's really, really good news. Because I know, in the pandemic, I felt like that was such a heightened focus because of the Tiger King, show that came out.
Yeah.
So I know a lot of people were interested in that.
Yeah, that was actually, it was it wasn't something that, it was more of a diversion, it looked like, for people to get away from thinking about the pandemic. But in actuality, it kind of really rose this up to the top of the pile about how what problematic this is.
Mm-hmm.
And again, that Pandemic Act is really, we've been talking about this for many, many years.
Yeah.
And now, because of this, we hope that we can get this bill passed through.
Well, Greg Dancho, I think that you make also a good point that this is where people can get involved. You can reach out to your local representatives or your local senators and voice your opinions on this. And Greg, we appreciate your fight at the front lines of all of this. And we thank you for all that you're doing. Thank you.
Thank you very much. And again, we're celebrating Earth Day and we're celebrating Party for the Planet. Get on our website. We're having lots of events this week, both virtual and at the zoo. We're doing a big river cleanup the Saturday and Sunday for the Pequannock River. So take a look on our website and on our Facebook page. A lot of good things happening. Again, Party for the Planet. It's our planet. Let's take care of it.
Mm-hmm. I couldn't agree with you more. Thank you so much, Greg. Always a pleasure.
Thank you.
We'll talk again next week.